Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. With traumatic brain injury, it can be very difficult to assess actually how much the brain has been injured, and even more importantly, to predict outcome. Our guest today is neuroradiologist Dr. Jerry York. He is a specialist not only in neuroradiologic techniques to look at traumatic brain injury, but also other diseases. The idea here is to probably spend a lot of the time, if not all, on traumatic brain injury and some of the imaging techniques that are being used to help us understand that problem better. However, if time permits, we may talk about Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or other neurologic diseases of the central nervous system. I think it's reasonable and worthwhile to also mention that although Dr. York works locally here for Imaging Associates in Alaska in Anchorage as a neuroradiologist, he has a number of special appointments that he's continuing to be involved in, and I want to mention those because it gives us some idea of the depth of his understanding of this particular problem. He's co-chair of the Department of Defense Neuroimaging Working Group for Traumatic Brain Injury. He's also a consultant for the Traumatic Brain Injury Neuroimaging Research, which is being done for the Defense Veterans Brain Injury Center. And also, he's been involved in some of the chronic encephalopathies involving NFL players as the U.S. Army representative to the NFL Army Medical Advisory Board on Traumatic Brain Injuries. Dr. York, it's a pleasure to have you take the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
What I'd like to do is start with some definitions, and then we'll kind of probably evolve into more complexity. I would like to also mention, because I often fail you to do it, because I get interested in getting into the program, but I want listeners to know how they can get a hold of us real quickly if they have questions or comments. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1. Just spell that out, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So what is a traumatic brain injury, since we're focusing on that?
So that is, it's an any alteration in brain function that happens because of a external force that's applied to the body or to the head. And that can be a result of a wide variety of injuries. So car wrecks, assault, sports injury. And what we see is alterations in how that patient is functioning neurologically.
You spent quite a bit of time in the military in the Middle East, as mm-hmm. we talked about before, and another injury is just a blast injury. And sometimes it may not be immediately present or understandable, including to people like myself, how a blast injury can cause some brain injury.
That's right. Yeah, blast injury is something that we started seeing after a few years in the Middle East and working around improvised explosive devices. And several characteristic things were some of the same things we see from blunt force trauma, so alterations in cognition, alterations in mood, alterations in the ability to remember things. And so, but the soldiers didn't really have any signs or symptoms of a true blunt force injury. It was just being exposed to the blast or being in close proximity to that blast wave. The blast wave echoes around inside the brain, inside the calvarium or the skull, and it causes disruption of white matter and can cause injury to specific structures inside the brain.
So you mentioned white matter. Let's define that. What's the difference between white and gray matter?
So gray matter is where the neurons are. So the actual dendrites and neuron bodies are in that part of the gray matter. And then the white matter, for the most part, are connective tissues as well as connective axons that relate to each parts of the brain. So cortex to cortex, cortex to deep gray nuclei, or the central sort of processing of the brain, and then the cortex of the brain to the body. All of those things are in white matter.
Yeah, this is difficult to do, and I forgot to maybe prep you about this possibility. But if you don't mind, let's paint the picture of a neuron and how that interacts. You've mentioned the term axon and dendrites. And
sure.
So just quickly paint us a little picture on the radio, which is what's tough, of what we're talking about here anatomically.
So the sort of a good way to think about it is the neuron or that part of the cell body or soma connects to several hundred or maybe even thousands of other neuron cell bodies in the cortex. And so that's, you think about it as a, sort of your CPU or your your main processing unit. And then the white matter part is sort of the wiring that connects that processing unit to the different parts of your computer or different parts of a system of computers.
So it's not unreasonable to make the analogy with a computer. It's not a perfect analogy. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But we now understand that these dendrites and linkages of neurons set up very specific circuits that improve with exercise. The more they're used, the faster, more accurately they get, and that helps us understand. I tell my parents why our brain is a good learning organ, but also why it's not a very good unlearning organ.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right, and which is important in cases like PTSD, where we're trying to unteach, like areas of the brain for that hyper response of being scared around situations. And that TBI and PTSD are very closely related in, as far as like brain injury things that happen. But to the point of training, yes, absolutely. So TBI can interrupt that process of actual being able to lay down new dendrites or the ability to connect neuron to neuron. And it can also disrupt the sort of that below the cortex is an area called the subcortical white matter. That's a very important part. It's a very sensitive part to injury. And what we see is in certain types of TBI, especially rotational things, those little connections that connect the neuron to the cell, to that axon, to that wiring, get disrupted.
And although we can see gray matter and white matter physically just with our eye, we don't see neurons.
That is correct. Not with the type of testing that we can do right now.
Just to get some idea of size that we're talking about. And so these neurons are talking to other neurons and forming certain circuits that do certain functions. And the connectivity is at the end of these dendrites to the nuclear to another neuron's body with some chemical reactions across this very, very tiny space.
That's exactly right. Chemical and electrical reactions, right?
Okay. What's a concussion then?
A concussion is essentially like a mild TBI. We tend to use concussion to refer probably to the more mildest form of a mild TBI. Usually those patients recover very quickly. They don't tend to have any permanent sequela of the actual injury that they've had. There is a process, and I know we're going to talk in a little bit about, but multiple concussions. So if you have multiple concussions, it can be as bad as having a more severe brain injury or more mild, higher mild or a moderate TBI.
So why, let's go ahead and just talk about why might that be?
Well, when you first injure the brain, there's a cascade of events that happen within the brain, and it has to do with the electrical and chemical reactions that we were just talking about and how the neurons are talking to each other. And so you get sensitized, so the brain is sensitized to any further injury, so that if another injury happens before the brain fully recovers, then it causes even more damage and further electrochemical problems as well as immune inflammatory problems within the brain.
So that first injury, in a sense, in my terms, lowers the threshold for subsequent injuries to cause even greater damage. There's just not the time to repair and get ready for another shock. And how long does that period last?
That's a great question, and I wish I could tell you exactly. But it depends on the severity of that initial concussion or mild TBI. It also depends on where that injury took place and how the injury took place and the type of recovery that the brain is allowed to have in between the successive concussive events.
So if I follow this line of thought pretty well, and we're talking about the concussion or the injury being of this electrical biochemical aspect of things, it makes me, it makes it clearer that it may be very difficult with some of the routine techniques to look at the brain to mm-hmm. see those changes. We're at a level of fidelity that we're not getting with a common CT scan, for example.
Absolutely.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely not with the CT scan. CT scan is a very good tool. It's actually an essential tool in the emergency room or in that acute event to determine whether or not that patient needs to go to surgery. Or not. However, if the brain is injured and you don't need to go to surgery and there's just a mild injury, you may actually not need to go on to another CT scan, but MRI may show us areas of edema, both on the cortex as well as below that level of cortex, the subcortical white matter, or areas of what's called hemosiderin, small areas of injury to the white matter that we can't see with CT.
What is chronic traumatic encephalopathy then?
So CTE is a process that was named by Dr. Omalu after looking at several professional football players that had a head injury and made famous by the movie Concussion that Will Smith played in this last year. But it's a actual injury of the brain, and we know now from the neuropathology that it's a disruption in the integrity of the neurons themselves, such that a protein called tau protein, which mm-hmm. is very important in the cytoskeleton of the neuron, and that tau protein is released into the surrounding brain, and then there's an immune reaction that takes place. But what sort of typifies chronic traumatic encephalopathy are changes in mood, changes in the ability to make decisions. We saw, a rash of NFL player suicides and other violent actions over the past several years that have been attributed to CTE. And confirmed on pathology, Junior Seau is probably the most recent one that we know about.
So if we're beginning to recognize physiologic findings on autopsy findings, something we can look at under a microscope, and I think I'm taking the implication from what you've said, we can maybe see in some of these neuroradiologic techniques we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then I've also heard that there's biomarkers that we might find in the blood that help us understand that. Are we getting closer to be able to predict what kinds of injuries specifically, the number and so forth, that are going to lead to specific findings of CTE?
Yeah, not necessarily the number of injuries maybe, but the changes that we see in the brain and predating the really severe sequela of those brain injuries. Mm-hmm. So a good example is, we weren't able to see areas of bleeding or these little deposits of hemosiderin in the brain until we developed, more sensitive techniques in MRI. And now we can actually find those. And so we're able to say, hey, this is somebody who's functioning normally now neurologically. But they are at very high risk if they have any more injuries of developing more of these and disrupting pathways within the brain that, could leave a permanent deficit. And so, yes, we are getting closer and closer to that point where we can actually say, this is a player or this is a serviceman or this is a worker who doesn't need to go back to doing that same activity again where that mm-hmm. exposes them to a high risk.
Mm-hmm. So it may not be the number of injuries,
yeah.
I'm using that in a broad sense, it may be the sequela of those injuries that we're able to better quantify that's going to make that prediction of who needs to stop doing this, decrease the risk of these things happening to
Yeah, them. That's absolutely true. And that's where this whole concept of individualized medicine that we talk about mm-hmm. frequently, mm-hmm. this is like you can't really get much more individualized than TBI because everybody's traumatic brain injury is slightly different than the next person. They have had a different severity, and now we know too maybe even a different genetic ability to heal those areas of brain and the sensitivity that individual has to the more permanent consequences of the brain injury.
I want to take just a second to remind listeners once again, this is Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is traumatic brain injury, and in particular, what neuroradiologic techniques are able to tell us about this and help us to learn more about. My guest is Dr. Jerry York. He's a neuroradiologist here in Anchorage with Imaging Alaska. Did I say that right?
Imaging Associates.
Did I
yes,
say it right
that's
before?
Right.
And certainly has a broad experience in these issues. If you've got questions or comments, let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us during the next now 45 minutes left. Local number 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, I was about to mention that there may be, I suspect, individual susceptibilities to these this likelihood of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And then you just mentioned, as we went to this reminder session of mine, that there may be genetic things. And so what you were saying, or what I heard you say, is, yeah, there may be different susceptibilities as well, getting to this individualized medicine kind of issue more and more.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we know from Alzheimer's disease, the APOE4 protein that's there that that can alter how plaques are laid down in Alzheimer's disease, or the sensitivity to that, that same genetic makeup actually may affect or has an association with more long-term consequences from traumatic brain injury. And as the genetic work gets better and better, and we look at more and more biomarkers, we know, there are a host of other inflammatory and microglial changes that happen inside that framework of the white matter and around the brain that will make patients more sensitive to the results of their traumatic brain injury.
So the word tau comes up in Alzheimer's, as you mentioned, in neurofibrillary yes. tangles and so forth. Tell me again what those are,
sure.
and we haven't mentioned the neurofibrillary tangles, as I say them, which are on Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's specific. I know tau is in Alzheimer's. These proteins are found as well.
So. Yeah, it is. There is a difference between tau and Alzheimer's, and neuropathology-wise, which I'm not an expert, but, just being in this field for a while. So the difference with CTE and Alzheimer's and how the tau plaques are laid down, the tau and CTE is usually laid down in the deeper sulci of the brain around vessels, whereas the Alzheimer's has a predilection for, like parietal and temporal lobe regions, not necessarily in those deep sulci, but you'll see them everywhere. The one feature that they both share is actually volume loss. So we can, see these patients, they'll go through this process of, having normal volumes on their MRI. And then you'll start to see these patients that are going to go through this process of early dementia or early mild cognitive impairment. They'll start falling off this normal curve that we have looking at, specific structures like hippocampal measurements as well as temporal lobe regions. And that same thing we will see with CTE, where there are regions of the brain that start to atrophy faster than normal.
Mm-hmm. And these findings are really felt to be, as I listen to you, the consequences of the injury, not the cause of the injury, which is always, you get this chicken and an egg question all the time when we start finding things like this.
Yeah, absolutely. It does relate to the behavioral and, cognitive and memory changes that we talk about, because those areas of the brain definitely are involved. But you're right, the volume loss isn't the cause of the injury. The injury caused the volume loss, which then led to the changes in volume and function.
Is it true that relatively minor injuries can have rather significant consequences?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things that when they were talking about CTE first, that those relatively mild traumatic brain injuries that they thought football players were having, say linemen, for instance, where they're constantly getting hit at the line every time, that, we thought that those injuries didn't mean anything because, the patients were, or the players weren't really having any problems immediately afterwards. But what we see is those are the guys that we're seeing, over time that actually really do suffer chronic effects of that mild traumatic brain injury or that small concussions over time. And that has to do with that sensitizing of the brain because of the electrochemical and inflammatory cascade that's going on after each one of those concussive events.
Mm-hmm. If I'm following what you're saying, then it does make sense after a athletic concussion, a car accident concussion, a fall on the ice concussion, to have a period of time where you're trying to protect your brain and let things recover.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where a lot of the guidelines for the NCAA and the NFL and even local high school sports, that's where those, you know, return to play guidelines have come from. And they're written in such a way to be flexible such that, you know, not every player has the exact same routine, although that we know that, you know, like light return to duty or light return to playing is better than nothing at all. So like you're trying to get the, you know, the player back as quickly as possible, but allowing their brain time to actually heal up.
In case listeners have heard the same thing that I've been through as a primary care physician about this, initially there was a lot of discussion of having the brain be quiet, not go to school, not think about things, just rest. And then what I think of as some reason came in and people said, but you can't put the brain at rest. So that is overdone now. Am I saying that correctly? I mean, kids may have trouble thinking and concentrating in school. They may have some attentional issues following this, but it's not necessarily correct to keep them out of the classroom is what I'm hearing you say.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, so you want to give them time to heal, but you don't want them to be completely unplugged from everything. And there are certain things that we know that are not the best, you know, like, for example, exposure to a lot of blue light from computer screens or TV, you know, for a lot of that initial period may not be the best thing. But all of that has to do with getting the brain to function back in a normal way, which can be, you know, it can be weeks, actually. It can be sometimes even months before a patient or a player is ready to go back and do what they're supposed to do.
I've kind of jumped ahead a little bit because I was very interested in what you're finding on the neuroradiologic techniques. But let's, so let's back up a second and talk about what is the usual method that people with concussion, traumatic brain injuries might be initially evaluated.
So the initial thing in the, like I was saying initially, in the ER or in the acute setting, CT scan is most commonly employed just because the real question is whether or not this brain injury is something that's neurosurgically significant. And if there is a large hemorrhage or something that can be decompressed, then that needs to take place first. However, the real sequela of a more mild injury, a mild TBI, you really can't see anything on that. And almost always you can't see anything on that CT, initial CT scan. We do have some data now that says that even on a normal CT scan that there could be changes that we can see on MRI in that acute phase. And that comes from a large multicenter trial called TRAC-TBI. And that TRAC-TBI study found that about 20 to 30% of normal CTs in those patients, they actually had abnormal MRIs within the first couple of weeks. And so what we tell providers, we don't tell them to automatically get MRIs, you know, on everybody that's had a traumatic brain injury, but somebody who is having persistent symptoms within that first couple of weeks, especially, it's worthwhile to get an MRI because it improves our ability to see edema, white matter changes, small areas of hemorrhage that we can miss on CT, just because of the resolution difference between the two studies.
So not everybody that has a concussion needs a CT scan.
Correct.
Clinically, you make a decision depending on the injury and your findings, and we're looking for acute things that might need surgical intervention. And not everybody that has a concussion or a traumatic brain injury needs an MRI. Again, clinically, if things are persisting, it may make sense. But it also sounds like we're also getting to the point where we ought to have a high index of suspicion of looking if persistent symptoms, because we may be able to start predicting some outcomes.
Yes, exactly.
And I had a very bad flashback when you were telling me about this of a boy I saw a number of years ago who was a wrestler who had a concussion. very bright guy, wanted to do sports, wanted to get back. But every time he started exercising for months, he would get a headache again. Hmm. And I remember at the time, my understanding was that most of the time CTs don't show anything. I don't remember thinking about the MRI. But it seems to me, and again, I may not be remembering this right, but recently I ran into a family member, and this must be 10, 15 years later. I think they told me he's having Parkinson's-like symptoms. Yeah. So that may not be unusual, is what I'm hearing you say, depending on where the injury happened that we might could have noticed it with a little bit more investigation back earlier.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think that's really the power of doing that follow-on imaging in that subacute setting, especially if they are having any of those symptoms, is that we can pick up changes in the brain that we wouldn't be able to see, you know, that we weren't able to see, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And the techniques that we have now with MRI and the specific ones that we look at are there's a sequence called FLAIR, and that's it's a very fluid-sensitive sequence, so it allows us to see changes in fluid of the gray matter or the cortex, like we talked about, or the white matter. There's a sequence called susceptibility-weighted imaging, and what that looks for is a real tiny, small areas of blood within the brain. And then there's a volumetrics that we use, a very high-resolution picture of the brain, and then we're able to compare that those subtle changes in volumes of different parts of the brain to a normal atlas and figure out if that patient lies within normal or if they're falling off of this normal curve faster than others. So those tools we now have available are very powerful and make our diagnosis and our prediction of future ability of patients and future symptoms much better.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, again, is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on newer radiologic techniques and traumatic brain injury with Dr. Jerry York. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Back. This is Line 1, your health connection, once again from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about neuroradiologic techniques and how they're helping us understand our brain disorders like traumatic brain injury. If time allows, we'll also talk about Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis. My guest is Dr. Jerry York. He's a neuroradiologist with Imaging Associates here in town, and he also has a number of ongoing associations with various research entities on traumatic brain injury in particular throughout the country, including those involving chronic traumatic encephalopathy with some of the NFL players. Don't forget that if you just tuning in and you wanted to hear more and you can always go to line1@alaskapublic.org. Look up the Line 1 archives from our website and listen to this program at any time. And I often fail to mention that on the website also, I often have reliable links. Dr. York's office website is linked on our website, the CDC website, which will give you a lot of basics of traumatic brain injury, the epidemiology, symptoms, and some of the preventative efforts that are going on. I also have a link to Boston University's Center for Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy, as well as a short video on that particular topic. While we're talking about prevention, it just dawned on me, we haven't, and I meant to ask earlier, why aren't helmets more protective?
They do protect the brain to a certain extent. They protect from a blunt force or direct trauma to the brain, especially. Unfortunately, no helmet can actually prevent you from the rotational or the inertial injuries that happen when you suddenly hit a hard surface or you're hit from the side. For instance, especially in football play, when you're hit from the side or from another angle and your brain is rotating inside your calvarium, there's no way to protect the brain from those type of motions that do cause damage. They cause damage because the brain can hit the inside of the skull, and they can also cause rotational injuries where pieces of the parts of the white matter, those connections or wiring pieces that we were talking about in the white matter, can tear. And so helmets are great, and I highly encourage them. We always, get our kids and even myself and my wife, when we do any activities outside, we're doing, like skiing or skating or whatever. But but unfortunately, they can't protect you from everything.
Yeah, I actually didn't come out of my mouth as well as I wanted to. I wanted to make a point that helmets are helpful, but they're not there's no way to prevent some of the concussive or injuries with shear forces and so forth that are happening inside our head.
Exactly.
It may help us from breaking our skull if we get hit by a baseball bat or fall off a bicycle.
That's correct. Absolutely.
So back to the initial evaluation of someone, typically driven by symptoms, maybe the history, what happened, how they're acting. CT lets us look at things that we may need to intervene very quickly, not very good fidelity. We don't see a lot of the much smaller, more tinier changes that you've talked about. The MRI can do that. And you mentioned some various changes and things you can do to MRI to actually improve that. Mm-hmm. What else do we need to know about newer techniques? What are they and what are they helping us understand?
So one of the techniques we actually have been using just for the past year or so here, but has been employed for the past 5 or 6 years elsewhere, is called diffusion tensor imaging. And what that does, a DTI for short, in MRI, it allows us to look at the actual bundles of white matter, not the individual axons themselves, but big bundles of the white matter, and how they look on this imaging tells us how intact those fibers are. So if I'm able to tell when I look at an area of the brain, and for example, there's an area in the brain called the centrum semiovale, which is a big area of white matter in the middle of the top of the brain. And I can see that area on all kinds of imaging, but when I look in on this particular technique with DTI, I can actually see how those fibers are oriented, how they tie to different areas of the cortex, and how they tie to the deeper parts of the brain. And that allows us to actually see changes, very subtle changes in the integrity of white matter, which we know is probably one of the more sensitive places that brain injury occurs. There are other techniques, some that are more research-oriented, like magnetic encephalography, where you actually, or MEG. Those are techniques where you're looking at the electrical activity on the outside of the brain. Unfortunately, it can only see a few millimeters to the inside of the cortex, so it's not able to interrogate some of the deeper structures in the brain. EEG is very similar. It looks at activity, electrical activity around the brain, but again, not a true, like an anatomic image to see exactly what changes have taken place.
What about functional MRIs? Is that what you were alluding to earlier when you were talking about some of these flare kinds of issues? And then what do we mean exactly? What can that do?
Yeah, functional imaging, it is a little different than flare. Functional imaging actually measures changes in blood flow using a sequence called BOLD. And that's, again, there's lots of acronyms in MRI. but it has to do with the level of oxygen and oxygenation of blood inside the brain. And so what we can do is we know when we see changes of this BOLD signal within the brain, those areas are in the brain are being activated more than other areas in the brain. So one of the big areas of research with TBI has been the interrogation or investigation of what's called the default mode network. And you can think of the default mode network inside the brain as the sort of the resting self. So just if you're just laying in bed, not doing anything, just, you know, thinking about nothing, then that those areas of the brain that are active and connected, that's called the default mode network. And so we actually have patients that do this inside the scanner. We can actually look using this called resting state fMRI. Now, if I give a patient a task, say tapping a finger or if we were able to brush their hand with a soft object or something or stimulate other areas of their body, we can actually see changes in the sensation or the motion that happens inside the brain using functional imaging. And that type of functional imaging we actually use for pre-surgical planning. So if there's a tumor or if there's something going on inside the brain, we'll do that type of imaging to allow the neurosurgeon to see areas that are active during that whatever particular activity that we're doing. And that tells them what areas of the brain that they're trying to stay away from as they're doing the resection. But for traumatic brain injury, there are people who have reported specific, and we talked about this before, people who have reported specific areas of the brain that may or may not have to do with traumatic brain injury. And unfortunately, those claims really haven't held up over, you know, a long period of time in scientific investigation. So the resting state is probably the best functional tool that we have right now in looking at TBI.
Once again, let me give you a couple of phone numbers. If you've got questions or comments, you have previous experiences that you would like to share with us with particularly traumatic brain injury, our email address is lineone, lineone, at alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. One of the problems in medicine and life in general is the huge increase in information that is exponentially increasing, like our ability to crank out computations in a computer. It's rapidly going. I have a feeling that it's very difficult for other physicians like me to keep up with these changes. I've learned a lot about the utility of just a typical MRI and other things I might want to investigate now in a patient that I've seen with some from head injuries now. Do you find that's true? If so, how do you get involved in saying, hey, doc, I think we need to be doing a little bit more here?
No, that's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that we've done over the past 6 months or so, we've tried to do more educational outreaches within the community. I'm involved now with the Alaska Brain Injury Network, and that's one of the things I would like to do for primary care providers around the state, is sort of introduce them to this whole concept of how imaging can help. And you know, people want to say, well, you know, I know what's going on with the patient. Why do I need to get the MRI? Well, as we talked about earlier, it helps you be a better clinician because it allows you to counsel that patient and say, hey, this is an activity you probably shouldn't engage in anymore because you have some really significant consequences on your scan. And I think of that like a calcium score for, you know, for heart disease. It may or may not help, you know, you diagnose that patient with heart disease, but it's going to help you counsel that patient and say, hey, your calcium score is, you know, whatever, and you need to take some certain steps in your life to help adjust or to prevent further disease from happening. And so MRI is helpful for that for clinicians. And quite honestly, it's also helpful because it reassures patients that they're not crazy. And I know that sounds sort of silly, but a lot of patients who have had a significant traumatic brain injury, I hear this very frequently. They'll come in and they'll say, you know, I've been to five different doctors. They all say that, you know, there's nothing going on. They can't find anything wrong. But I know that there's something wrong with me. I'm very foggy when I'm trying to think about things. I can't remember like I used to. Mm-hmm. And so we are able to see those changes on MRI, either from volume changes or from edema in the brain or white matter injury. And so we can reassure that patient, yes, you're not crazy. You do have real sequela or real findings from traumatic brain injury. And then you're able to talk to clinicians and sort of get them on a track where they can start to do some of the therapies, the cognitive therapy or other interventions that might help them with whatever deficit they have.
One of the questions I had in my mind coming in is from a very naive understanding of what you're doing with these newer techniques, but it seems reasonable to ask, and that's the reproducibility, the fidelity issue. And I say that only because in medicine, we have a long, long history of getting excited about certain things until we start trying to reproduce studies, and then that doesn't happen so much. How reproducible are the findings with MRI that you've discussed that seem to be correlating very good with outcome, for example? Let's take that one in particular.
Yeah, so the MRI test, certainly the being able to see flare changes or sort of these macroscopic changes in the brain using, I guess, more anatomic techniques, those are definitely things that have been proven over and over again. And MRI has been around for about 40 years. And the ability to see those changes in the brain, we know from that length of time are reliable. The newer techniques, and the biggest one that probably the most controversial one right now is diffusion tensor imaging. And you'll see it used in the court system. You'll see it used in a lot of clinical trials and trying to say that people are able to pick out certain areas and certain changes on DTI. DTI is a highly—it's a very complex physics sequence that happens in the MRI, and it can change the measurements that you see from DTI in one scanner can be very different from another scanner. And so trying to generalize or say these one area or this one thing that we're seeing on this one particular technique means that you had a TBI, it's very difficult. And so I think the best thing that we can do is offer this sort of multi-parametric or multi-modality almost within MRI, a whole bunch of different measurements that when we put that together, it makes a lot of sense. And we always try to interpret it with the ability to talk to the clinician. So being able to call you and say, hey, you know, these are the things I'm seeing on MRI. Does that sort of go with what you're seeing clinically? And that's the reliability and the validity that we see with the imaging techniques that we're using because we verify with the clinician that it fits with the areas of the brain that are injured or that we're seeing changes on the MRI.
I also like to ask the question specificity and sensitivity, and I'm want to do that in the sense that I'm particularly in this program and as a primary care physician, I often see patients who have a symptom, get on the internet, and they don't have the perspective that that symptom may transcend numerous problems. Mm-hmm. And so I can envision people listening to the program having certain symptoms after a headache or after a head injury, or having symptoms who had never had a head injury. How do we discuss this information of specificity and sensitivity of these findings?
Yeah, it is much more complex, definitely, than say looking at a carotid stenosis or coronary stenosis. Unfortunately, it's not. It's objective. It's much more objective than we've ever been with MRI. But because the nature of TBI is so heterogeneous, then it becomes very difficult to pinpoint, you know, one particular part of the test or one particular thing that allows us to say, yes, this is a very sensitive or this is a very specific test. The best thing that we can do, and this is what we had talked about earlier, is if they're still having symptoms, if the patient's still having symptoms, then we can look, and then we can talk about what we see when we look. And do I see on every traumatic brain injury, do I see, patients that are having symptoms? Do I see something? No, that's absolutely, maybe 10% or 15% that I won't see any changes at all, even given the most advanced techniques that we have. And a lot of that has to do with the resolution where we are right now in traumatic brain injury imaging and how far we can see into the brain and how well we can see those connections that are happening in the brain. And I'm hopeful, that the research that we're doing with the NFL and with the DOD, that further on that we'll be able to, we'll get better and better at that. But yeah, right now I'd say, you know, at least in that sort of 80 to 90% range, I would say, as far as specificity, being able to tell if there's significant sequela of a prior traumatic brain injury.
Barbara, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Well, number one, what does sequela mean? What's the definition?
Yeah, that's the outcome. What happens afterwards? So if you stub your toe, what's infection, pain, broken bone? There's things that may come down the road after that injury.
Okay, good. That's good to know. So how long do the symptoms or the effects of concussion or, you know, a hit to the head, like several hits to the head, how long do those last?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's part of that whole idea of, you know, it's such a heterogeneous thing, and depending on the force that was involved and exactly the area of the brain that was injured, it can actually last for a lifetime in the case of, you know, somebody who ends up developing Alzheimer's disease or other chronic neurodegenerative problems because of the trauma, or it can resolve. And I would say the vast majority of, especially mild traumatic brain injuries, the vast majority of patients with those, they resolve, their symptoms resolve. And that, you know, is in the like 80% range that will just get better on their own. It's that persistent concussive symptoms, those patients who still are having symptoms after the head injury, those are the ones that we're trying to figure out exactly what's going on and if we can help them.
And I'd point out that the research will take a long time. You're going to have to follow a fairly large group of people over a long period of time to really get better answers.
Like a longitudinal study.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And that study is actually, there is a large study that's being done by the VA and the DOD right now called the Chronic Effects of Neurotrauma Consortium. That's a lot of words just saying that they're looking at the chronic changes of the brain in veteran and DOD populations. And that study is actually, the goal of that study is to enroll about 5,000 veterans. There is a lot of work that's going into being able to, and a big part of that study is actually looking at neuroimaging and what are the neuroimaging techniques that we can use to pick up changes in the brain that lead or that may signify that patient's going to go on and get Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease.
Okay. So that leads me to the other. Well, I have fallen several times. I mean, more than five times. And hit my head like backwards on the ice. Several falls down some stairs at my place of work, which was a school. I'm retired now, and I was sent to go get a psychological evaluation, and I did not do well on the psychological evaluation. And I don't know if I'm wondering if a lot of those falls, you know, had anything to do with it. Plus, as a kid, you know, I think I was 7 years old. I wanted to see what it would feel like to fall down like a tree, like timber, and I did that. And I never told anyone.
Sure. So that's, you're describing sort of the classic. That's the classic history and the classic case that we see, and I see that every single day. Patients that have had, you know, multiple head injuries, and they have these symptoms, but they don't know why they're having symptoms, and they've, you know, may or may not have seen, you know, or done psychological testing like you've done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times clinicians will sort of dismiss them and say, you know, we don't know what's going on with you, but I can't find it. But that's exactly where right now that objective measure that we have, the best thing that we have right now is the ability to do an MRI and look for volume changes and look for those edema or fluid changes in the brain that we just couldn't see before.
Okay, so that brings me to the last question, is that, you know, if it hasn't just happened, it's not an acute, you know, injury, I mean, would it be worth someone's while to
For the MRI,
take a look at it.
Yeah, absolutely, and that actually is what we see most often. Are patients that have had multiple head injuries over several years, And it really takes on the MRI. We can see changes within that first couple of weeks, but the real value of MRI is following those, you know, following over time. So we can see you in, you know, like 6 months or a year and see changes. So if your head injury was several years ago, or if you've had multiple head injuries over several years, then that MRI is definitely the best test to look for those changes or those chronic changes. Yes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Sure thing.
Appreciate your answers.
Thank you for calling.
So Barbara's question raises another question in my mind, is the ability, and this gets to specificity of these tests, how good is this at detecting these changes that you can attribute to injury from other causes of changes in the brain, particularly aging?
Yeah, so that's where the ability to measure these volumes and then look at a normative database. And so when we talk about a normative database, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of patients that are your particular age. And so we're able to compare your brain to their group of brains. And so that allows us to know sort of where you fall on that curve. And like anything, like a CBC or, you know, any kind of blood test that we do where we have a normal range, it's the same concept. You know, we're looking
what's the likelihood of your findings being in this normal range? It doesn't say you're normal or abnormal. It just, the farther you're away from that normative range, the more concerning it might be that this is
absolutely
a different, a specific problem.
Absolutely. And there are certain patterns that we see in TBI that are a little different from things like stroke or, you know, a small vessel ischemia or other, you know, neurodegenerative things. You know, the asymmetry of brain injury makes it much easier to detect in that way because we look for that asymmetry on the scans.
All right. We're starting to get a little bit of interest in this program, at least people calling in and writing in. So here's an email that I'm going to try to work through here. It says, after a blast, I'm not sure what that means, in 2007, 2008, I was checked out and given the all clear. As time progressed, my short-term memory has gotten to the point where I can set my mind to do something, close the garage door after bringing the trash in, for example, and completely forget to do it almost every time. I also have daily dizzy spells, blurred vision, headaches, although not as severe as they used to during my annual physicals the past year. The doctor I see says my lab looks fine, vital signs are not important, it's not showing up there. So I'm getting the feeling here that depending on the significance of that blast and the evaluation, that here's another individual that needs to be considering the possibility that something is going on in his brain with affecting his short-term memory, whether it's related to trauma or some other problem. It might behoove him to have more investigation.
Yes, absolutely. And again, that is sort of a classic history that we see. We work with the DOD and Air Force patients, and as well as our Army patients here locally, and veterans groups, and we're able to see changes chronically from a blast injury from, you know, that happened 10, 15 years ago. Yes.
Kidoki. Another caller. Who we got? Jim, you're on line one.
Thank you for taking my call. Doctors, I've been trying to get answers, and I think that you folks finally have the answer to. I've got many years of land, sea, and air rescue with the feds and with the state troopers here in Alaska, and I've taken quite a number of injuries. I've had head bashes in two or three car wrecks and skied off a mountain on another one into a pile of stumps. And I'm kind of like a bobble-headed doll on the dashboard of your 57 Chevy on a bad road. I've shaken everything apart. I have trouble with balance, and sometimes when I'm trying to walk, I can ricochet off both sides of the walls of any hall. And in bending my head forward or back and looking especially to the left, I can have a vertigo. I've had a couple of bouts of vertigo in the last year. I have gone to almost everybody around for all the other injuries I've had, and I've also been examined by a brain specialist here in the Wasilla area. I have a MRI from, I think it was December, and been planning on making an extensive trip outside to try to find these answers. And now, as I usually do when I hear something really good, it comes off line one. Happened to be listening to you today.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And you had a question, I'm sorry.
Well, yes, my question is, what are some of these things? I've been evaluated for the possibility of encephalopathy from traumatic, from my head jerking back and forth, And it seems that when I get tired in my neck, I will start to develop this pain going up into the back of my head and then into the top of my head and then around to the front. And I have had these MRIs, and the last doctor said, well, no, I do not have dementia and I don't have Alzheimer's. There may be a slight lessening of fluid in my brain, but some of the other things that the other doctors have said is that if there's not an even flow of the spinal fluid into the brain, that can become stagnant and then infected, and that can cause this kind of problems. Evidently, there is a white matter pattern on the brain that shows on the MRI.
Yeah, and that is something that we can see, especially using the quantitative imaging, you know, that we're able to measure changes in those volumes of the brain. And so we can look at the areas where CSF is within the brain, and we can look at the white matter in the cortex around the whole brain. So it is, we do have an office actually in Wasilla. I'm not sure if you went to the imaging associates out there, but we do have a place that you can go to get imaging there and do this same technique, the quantitative imaging of the brain for the traumatic brain injury protocol that we have.
Okay. Do you want to, somebody give me that off the air, or can you broadcast that ethically and What the name of that place is.
It's actually on the website. I think they put it on there, but it's imagingak.com. So imagingak.com. And that'll give you information on the website. And it has information specifically about the techniques that we're using as well.
Okay. And then I would see them about setting up an appointment soon.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much, folks.
Yes, sir. Thanks for calling.
Have a good day, Jim. Got a couple of minutes left. Just one question real quickly, and then I want to give you some time to make sure we go over the things we want to hear from or remember from this visit. Somebody wanted to know, is local research being done on some of these issues we've talked about, or is this really something that's going on at major research centers elsewhere?
Yeah, there is local research as far as being able to look at some of the scans that we've done and reviewing those and comparing them to the national database. It is possible to enroll into the CENC. The closest site that's actually doing that is in San Diego, I think, right now on the West Coast. But so the actual local research, we're working on that to get approval to recruit patients here, too.
So we got about a minute, and I've gotten in the habit of ending this with trying to reinforce what we want people to take away from the program. So give me your top three or so things we want to remember.
Sure. So I think the very first thing is what you said earlier is that helmets are important. They're not to be dismissed, and they are important for your kids to wear. The number two, I would say that there are techniques that we have now available that are newer techniques in MRI where we can see changes on brain imaging that we couldn't see before in patients with traumatic brain injury. And probably number three is that that this is something that I'm always glad to discuss with clinicians or even patients, you know, if they have specific questions about things, you know, offline, we're able to talk about cases and review them.
All right. I really want to say my thanks to Dr. York for being here, Anchorage neuroradiologist Dr. Gary York. He works at Alaska Imaging, and he has extensive knowledge of the issue, particularly of traumatic brain injury, and often, as you can tell, extensive knowledge about some of the newer techniques, and has been very, very helpful in helping me understand a little bit more of what I need to be doing as a physician. So I hope our listeners have gained from it as well. Thanks very much, Dr. York.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the Line 1 archives. We'd also appreciate any thoughts or suggestions at that our email address at alaskapublic.org. Next week, our co-host, Dr. Prentice Pemberton, will be discussing prevention and treatment of common heart problems with cardiologist Dr. Jonathan McDonough. Why not join him at 2 o'clock next Monday on 91.1 Alaska Public Media. David Walton was today's audio engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.